This is Work in Progress, a show about the meaning and identity we find in work. From Slack. Slack is where work happens, at places like BuzzFeed and Chaya, a restaurant that serves vegan and vegetarian tacos in Washington, D.C. More on them at the end of the show. Check us out at slack.com/podcast or tweet us at Slack Stories. I'm Dan Meisner, and this week we have two stories about finding salvation through work, whether that means living your life as a reclusive nun, or in the case of a former Wall Street recruiter, fighting your own personal demons while helping others get back on their feet. And we start with a very spiritual vocation. Here's producer Lily Ames.
From an early age, Rachel Denton preferred to be alone. And when she was alone, like many children, she would retreat into her imagination. And it wasn't exactly an imaginary friend.
You know, I used to play with God in the way that most people would sort of, you know, play at being doctors and nurses, and that's what I play at being a nun.
It's not like she didn't like other children. They just made her tired.
I think that's classic introvert, that need to sort of rejuvenate away from other people.
When it came time for Rachel to choose a vocation, there really was only one obvious option. A young Catholic introvert dreaming of a quiet existence with God. She became a Carmelite nun at age 22.
When I went into the convent, you know, I intended to stay there.
But there was one tiny problem.
Living with 16 other women, really, it just is not me. They were lovely, you know, at least I'm sure they were lovely. And I got on very well with them, but it was exhausting.
Rachel was beginning to learn that she was a capital I introvert. And a convent is a busy place. She had to make a plan to get out.
I remember kneeling in chapel when I was pretty sure I was going to have to go. And saying, you may well want me here, God, but I know that I cannot live this way of life. You know, I can feel myself not doing well here. And if you're the sort of God that I believe you are, then you'll come with me when I leave. And then I left and discovered God was still with me.
Rachel knew exactly what she wanted to do. She was still a nun, but she wanted to be a solitary one. She wanted to be a hermit.
It's who I am. It's my role.
Let's take a pause here. What do you know about hermits? Caves, long beards, grumpy men. That's most people's assumption. And it's okay if that's what you picture, because they really aren't common knowledge. A hermit is a religious classification from the Old Testament. It means someone living in seclusion, dedicated to prayer and God. It's Rachel's dream job. She called up her bishop to make it real. She sold her house in upscale Cambridge and set out to find a hermitage.
You know, I had very romantic ideas about a little detached cottage on the sea, on the coast, that sort of thing.
But those romantic ideas never work out, do they? Instead of a cottage on the sea, a 1960s semi-detached house in the East Midlands became her hermitage. Unlike being a nun, there isn't a support structure for hermits. Being a hermit doesn't pay.
Naively, really, I'd half expected that when I came, and it was a shock. It was a shock when I came here to realise that being a hermit meant diddly squat, you know, that really nobody was going to buy anything from you just because you're a hermit. It took a long time, first of all, for me to come to terms with that.
Rachel was going to have to find some way of creating an income without heavy interactions with the public. She was following the paths of ancient hermits like St. Anthony. But there wasn't exactly a guidebook on paying your taxes as a hermit. And the more she tried to find ways to opt out of society, the more she had the sense that she wasn't being a good Christian.
there were days when I, when it became apparent to me that, that it was total selfishness and really I ought to be out there serving the poor on the streets and, you know, and running a soup kitchen and all that sort of thing.
She prayed for answers.
That God sits in heaven and says, well, of course you're selfish, you know, you're human.
Rachel decided to set up a small calligraphy business selling religious prints and tutors for a couple of hours a week. This brings her out of her hermitage, but she finds solace knowing the rest of her time is spent with God.
It's not the time sitting here having visions and you know, and great halos and sunsets speaking to me of angels and anything like that. It's not that. To be alive and to be with God is sufficient. And that experience in itself is remarkable and extraordinary. And that's what I want to explore. That's the adventure.
And on those days when she allows herself to opt into society, she doesn't even have to leave her hermitage. She takes to Facebook and Twitter and evangelizes hermit life. Thank you, social media.
A lot of people regard being a hermit or being a nun as a good thing to do, you know, as an honourable thing to do, as something that should earn me respect. I don't see it that way. It's just what I do, you know. It's some people get married, some people are nuns, some people are hermits. Deus fortis, pater futuris seculi,
princeps pacis.
If you want to follow Rachel the Hermit Nun on Twitter, her handle is Hermit Rachel. She describes her tweets as rare but precious. In Rachel's case, and in the Christian tradition, grace refers to the love and mercy of God. But there's another dimension to grace, and though it's not entirely religious, it is spiritual. When you're experiencing hardship or loss, grace can lead to salvation, redemption, a way out. And that's what our next story is all about. The grace that happens at the very bottom, when you have to start over and begin again. Producer Mio Edelman has the story of one woman who's made it her life's work to help others find their own grace.
It's a cold fall afternoon in Portland, Maine, and Margot Walsh has a problem.
I wasn't trying to like skip out on work or anything like that.
Margot runs a construction temp agency, and one of her employees has left the job site without her permission. It's his first day with the company.
Okay, but then you asked me for an advance on a day of pay, but you were already leaving at noon. What you have to understand, Rob, I'm very cynical.
Margot's in her pickup truck going from job to job. She's really busy overseeing operations, so figuring out what's happening isn't easy.
Okay, so can you go back to work?
I can. I'll have to get a ride out there.
You're driving with a person. Who picked you up?
No, I got out of their car. They picked me up. They saw me. They picked me up there by Washington.
This all sounds so... Wait, you're at Portland probation?
I was just there, yeah.
He says he's been called in for a meeting by his probation officer, but Marco isn't buying his story.
The reason I'm not happy is because you're telling me that someone from probation arbitrarily pulled you in the middle of the day, which is completely unreasonable and out of the ordinary.
If you're wondering why Margo has hired someone on probation, I mean someone who recently got out of prison, it's because her company, it's called Maine Works, only employs ex-felons. Most of them are also recovering drug addicts and alcoholics, but they are guaranteed work as long as they stay clean and sober and out of trouble. In fact, earlier that morning at 5:30 a.m., I was standing in a dimly lit, chilly 7-Eleven parking lot as about 40 guys, mainly guys, all of them ex-cons, emerged from the shadows, ready to work on painting crews, road crews, and construction crews. And they seemed pretty happy to be there.
Where were you at today? Grab what you need.
You didn't go to the meeting last night that everybody went to.
I went to Maine Med.
Dottie, you going to Nome? Landscaping?
I'll be painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, over on North Street, and then we're heading over to Brick Hill.
You need a hard hat, glasses, and a vest.
These guys are all making the choice to do an honest day's work. Surprisingly, not always an easy decision.
They could so easily, and I hear it all the time, it's easier to be incarcerated. I have three hots and a cot. They refer to that all the time. They can work out. They can, you know, but when they're on the street, you either can fall into street behavior where it's actually quite easy to make a good living, or you can fight against it constantly. And so I think that the secret sauce for MaineWorks is the gritty resolve of our employees to show up every day, to act right, to ask for more, and to be able to work those long hours.
Hold the line. This is Greg Alexander, who came from Western Pennsylvania on an airplane, detoxing on the plane, and now he is here running his life beautifully.
101 days sober. I'm doing warehouse work, so just organizing deliveries. I'm going back to Pennsylvania for a court date. It's for a possession and paraphernalia charge, so hopefully I'm allowed to come back.
In exchange for this life-affirming choice, Margo helps him out in many ways.
And here's extra large and large vests so you can wear them over your coats, especially high visibility. And you guys, I have these gloves. They're not fancy, but they're at least a barrier.
She also personally picks up some of them every morning at 5. And if they need it, she'll help them get a bed in a sober living house, or get their teeth fixed, or even help them get into school.
What's the last possible day that you can enroll in that class? How am I going to get the money to the state of Maine in time for you to be sitting in that chair?
I'm not even sure. Just got to, like, send it, post a money order.
Okay, but Damien, I need the address, and I need the exact amount.
Like, it's in your messages.
Okay.
But every once in a while, rarely, actually, Margo has to deal with an employee who isn't ready, like today. Margo is still on the phone with that new employee who left work when his probation officer just happens to pull up next to Margo's truck.
Wait, hang on a second. Kim, I've got Rob on the phone. Are you looking for him right now? Yeah, he thinks you're calling him.
So what did they say?
They said that she just left the office this minute.
So he hasn't been trying to get in touch with her?
No, and he hasn't been at the office.
So he was just trying to work half a day to get enough money to do something.
Oh, busted. Margo's suspicions have been confirmed, but this guy is the least of her worries. She'll deal with him later. You see, MaineWorks is not a nonprofit organization with a long list of donors. It's a unique for-profit business operated by a skeleton staff on very thin margins. The company gets little institutional support despite becoming the first place many institutions, I'm thinking correctional, law enforcement, addictions, turn to for help when an ex-con or a newly sober addict needs a job. It's a lot of work. So why does Margo do it? I mean, this wasn't her original career path. She used to have a high-powered job, making lots of money working on Wall Street. The Casco Bay off Maine's south coast is a beautiful, idyllic seascape. But like much of Maine, the picturesque surroundings mask a drug epidemic destroying this generation's youth. Margo grew up here. Both her parents were Irish immigrant doctors. Compared to many of her current employees, she had a lot of opportunities. But even back then, in the 60s and 70s, the coastline hid similar secrets.
My parents drank. Both of them drank a lot. So it was part of the fabric of our growing up. My parents actually mixed drinks in this closet that was part of the kitchen. So they both were drinking privately and hiding and concealing how much they were drinking.
And Margo herself learned at an early age the cost of keeping secrets.
We would scrape money out of our parents' pockets and go and sort of pick through all the penny candy and buy some and steal some and then go down to the beach and stuff as much candy as we could because we were forbidden to have sweets in our house, needing it desperately, and then going home and lying about it. And that is the essence of my own addiction. And I discovered wine at the age of 15, and it started from there. drinking as much as I possibly could to get that washed over feeling that I used to get from sugar, lying about it, behaving really badly, and then finally having to be full of shame and regret because I had to lie about it.
At the same time, though, Margot was usually a good kid.
As a child, I always wanted to help people, and I thought I would be a psychologist. I had this incredible need to know about everyone's life. And when we would go on car rides, I would press my face against the window and need to know the stories of what happened inside those houses.
This interest in others would serve her well years later. Armed with a psychology degree, she lucked into a recruiting job at Goldman Sachs in Manhattan on Wall Street. Her job? Hiring the brightest kids right out of Ivy League schools to join the brokerage.
I mean, it really is the hallowed halls of Wall Street. And the parquet floors gleam, the rugs are pristine, and the original artwork on the walls is unbelievable. And the people reflect that within Goldman Sachs. There is this incredible standard of excellence. And I was in the mortgage trading department. So that was pretty much feeding my ego of exactly where I wanted to be.
Except there was a problem.
The qualifications of the people that you're rubbing shoulders with are mind-numbing. And to me, I went to Wheaton, which at the time was considered a good school, but it's not Harvard, Yale, Stanford. And so I always felt like I had to catch up or make up for something, a deficiency. A trademark of addiction is an egomaniac with a profound insecurity complex. So reconciling those two things was always a challenge for me.
And the cure for that? Booze.
In New York City in the late 80s, everybody drank. Actually, everybody did a ton of cocaine. It was swashbuckling drunk all the time. And I could keep it tight enough while I was out to be very social, but never messy outside. But then when I would get home, I would continue drinking. And that's when you start to realize you can't stop.
And when she changed companies for an even better job in Connecticut, the drinking issues followed Margot. It culminated in 1997 at Christmas during a nightmare weekend.
We were going to Maine for Christmas and ended up being overnight at a friend's house in Massachusetts and drinking copiously. And then this drunken row happened. It was just the late night, ridiculous, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf type of setting. And the cops came and my sober husband got pulled from the scene. So now I'm like devastated that I've caused this and no one would talk to me. And so everybody left and I was by myself and I drove back up to Maine by myself to my father's house. And I woke up that day not remembering any of it and then all alone. And no one would talk to me. So I was now viciously hungover, profoundly shameful and full of guilt, and found the phone book and looked up AA.
Margot went into rehab.
And my liver count was that of an old man. I was covered with bruises from this crazy thing. I fell down the stairs. And then waking up in the rehab, there was a man at the end of the bed, and he said, "Are you done?" And finally I had to say, "Yeah, Uncle, yeah, I guess I am done." But all the while, I was so pissed that I was there, because I didn't want to stop drinking even then. I just was holding on to my right to not stop.
Despite the obvious damage to her life, Margot still wanted to drink. So why did she stay sober?
I had done such a show on my family and had been such a disaster, and the shame was overwhelming. So shame had finally taken over.
It was back to that childhood feeling of shame, contrite but ashamed. And as she sobered up, that harmful mix of ego and insecurity had a profound effect on Margot's career.
I was so still hung up in the image of being a washed up alcoholic that I never recovered professionally. I was so full of shame now. I hated the idea of people talking about me. So I never really gave it my all again.
But then, thanks to recovery, her shame started to lift.
I didn't have to reconcile good girl, bad girl within the halls of recovery. In recovery, you meet on your lowest, you meet broken, which I think is amazing. And I couldn't believe there was actually a place where you could show up absolutely broken and be welcomed.
This new feeling of inclusion would stay with Margot and have a profound impact on her future. But first, after convincing her husband to move back to Maine, Margot settled into a life of relative ease. Career happily took a backseat to recovery and raising kids. But then, at over 10 years sober, Margot and her husband decided to divorce. They had simply grown apart.
It was awful. That was the worst time of my life. Saying you're done and then telling your children that you're getting divorced.
It was around that time that Margot attended a lecture given by renowned defense attorney F. Lee Bailey. He was one of O.J. Simpson's lawyers and also one of the inspirations for the 60s TV show The Fugitive. But at this talk, Bailey spoke about the importance of putting ex-convicts to work. He argued that it greatly reduced the chance of them reoffending. The talk would change Margot's life.
At the same time, I was working at the Cumberland County Jail, and I could feel these young men wanting to make a change, wanting to do something, but having no conduit. So I thought, how can I possibly find a way to bring these guys out of the jail into employment as a recruiter?
So using her skills as a white-collar corporate recruiter, Margot started to connect the dots, but in a blue-collar way. With a small loan from her sisters, just a few thousand dollars, Margot started Maine Works. And instead of combing Ivy League schools for future captains of industry, she started recruiting prospects right out of jails and rehabs.
Well, it's entirely different, of course, because in one setting, you're leveraging a life into financial security and material wealth. And on my current agenda, I have Maslow's hierarchy of needs at play. Where are you sleeping tonight? Have you eaten? You know, what are you doing to get a little bit of money? And then from there to leverage to say, what do you really want to do?
You need a bus pass. We don't have any bus passes right this minute. Let me see if I can scare up a dollar for you.
Unlike at Goldman Sachs, Margot finally felt like she was working with her people.
I would rather work with the intensity of the broken place, the vulnerable, the outcast. That's where grace happens. At the absolute bottom, the burgeoning sense of redemption that's possible at that level, to me, is what I see every single day of my life.
And how does this inform the way Margot's going to deal with that guy, Rob, the one who skipped out of work early?
What I think about Rob is put him on a really tight leash, drill down about this discussion, talk about this level of dishonesty.
So you will give Rob a
chance? Oh, yes. Oh, well, but after a very stern discovery. I'm not just letting that go at face value.
We all yearn for the campfire. We all need it. In our DNA, it says gather. Gather, come together. My ancestral DNA is Irish, and we come together. And you don't exclude people based on their behavior. Rather, you include them even more aggressively. That is tribal. But we are so disparate in this day and age, and it's a growing isolation. So I feel compelled to pull people together even tighter. It's our American dream. When you look at the poem at the bottom of the Statue of Liberty, it says, "Bring us your huddled masses, tempest-tossed, to me, yearning to breathe free." We said that in our own country, but it doesn't happen for anybody. It happens for the elite. So I feel this urgency to spread that message, inclusive of everyone, no exceptions.
When is the first day you're going to be able to work a full day?
Tomorrow. I can work tomorrow, full day.
All right.
And so, well, Rob didn't show up for work the next day as he promised. But when he's ready, Margot will be there waiting for him with open arms, without judgment, because she's been there herself. So if you're listening to this, Rob.
I
was just telling Lester, you guys are killing it.
We got a good group.
Oh my God. Like, it's, I don't think they've ever seen anything like it. I don't mean to blow you up like that, but, and I also, but I also really, really value what you're doing. Hi.
Work in Progress is a show from Slack. All kinds of teams use Slack, like Chaya, a taco restaurant in D.C. Here's how they use it.
Hi, my name is Bettina Thompson Stern. I am the co-founder of Chaya, a seasonal vegetable taco company in Washington, D.C. Chaya is female-powered, and we aim to be on the right side of change by creating a better food system. We have conversations ranging from branding and marketing to kitchen operations, future store buildouts, staff notes, and larger financial concerns. We keep photos of private party table designs, broken items in need of repair, as well as keeping some files for safekeeping or future use or discussion. Slack is the ultimate collaboration tool for Chaya.
To find out more about Slack or to get in touch, visit us. We're at slack.com/podcast or tweet us @SlackStories. I'm Dan Meisner. Thanks for listening.